Not being able to conceive is disappointing and can be a very challenging obstacle. Luckily, though, if you've been unsuccessful in becoming pregnant or other circumstances prevent you from carrying a child, third-party reproduction might just help you achieve your dreams of becoming a parent. Here with us to discuss is Dr. Tomer Singer, a board-certified specialist in reproductive endocrinology and infertility with Shady Grove Fertility. This is the Shady Grove Fertility Podcast from Shady Grove Fertility. My name is Prakash Chandran. So first of all, Dr. Singer, really great to have you here today. I'd love to start by asking, what exactly does third-party reproduction mean?
Thank you. Great being on the podcast. So third-party reproduction is any situation when in a process of fertility treatment, we are using either an egg donor, a sperm donor, or a gestational carrier for the purpose of conception.
Sperm donor, egg donor, or gestational carrier. So really what it is that anytime you're using a third party to have a baby, is that correct?
Correct. So we have a lot of ways to have families these days, and if it's a single patient, single female patient, she will be needing a donor sperm. If it's a patient who has low ovarian reserve, she will be needing an egg donor. If it's a patient that her uterus is not functioning very well, she will be in need of a gestational carrier, someone else to carry the pregnancy. The bulk of the patients are in need of a sperm donor or egg donor, and a small portion of patients have a dysfunctional uterus that will require using someone else's uterus.
Okay, understood. And so you're obviously speaking to this a little bit, but I wonder who is this best suited for, or who are the patients that you most commonly see?
So, you know, I practice in Manhattan, New York for the last 15 years, and there's a good proportion of my patients that are single females in their 30s or 40s that are either freezing eggs or later on are becoming a single mom by choice. And these are the type of patient that will need a sperm donor. So we'll be using an anonymous sperm donor from a sperm bank and then do either insemination or do IVF in order to help them conceive. The egg donation is more appropriate for patients who had failed prior treatment with IUIs, with IVFs, or had tried to conceive well into their 40s or were diagnosed with premature ovarian failure or have been treated with chemotherapy and radiation in the past, causing their ovaries not to be able to produce healthy eggs. In those cases, we will be using an egg donor.
Okay, that makes sense. You know, I imagine that another group of people that use third-party reproduction as an option are members of the LGBTQ plus community. So are those also patients that you see often?
Very much so. Every week we will be seeing patients who are either same-sex female or same-sex male. I have two couples who are same-sex male this week, and they're in need for both an egg donor who is currently cycling and a gestational carrier who is going to be able to carry the embryo after it's being created. In their case, it's called dual insemination, so both male partners will be producing sperm, will be taking the donor eggs upon retrieval and splitting those eggs between the two male recipients, creating embryos. Once the embryos have been created, we will go ahead with the transfer, and that transfer will be transferred into a surrogate or gestational carrier at a later stage. When it's two females who are married or together trying to conceive, there's two scenarios. One of them is when one of them is having an IUI with a donor sperm, and the other option is using each other's eggs in something called co-IVF, meaning one patient is having a retrieval, we're using a sperm donor, and then we're transferring that embryo into her female partner.
Okay, thanks so much for explaining those dynamics. So one of the things that I wanted to do was to unpack each one of those three methods individually. So let's start with the sperm donor method. So you mentioned that an anonymous donor is chosen from a sperm bank. Is there ever a case where the patients might want to choose the sperm based on characteristics, or is it completely anonymous and you get what you get? Maybe explain how that works.
Oh, that's a very good question, and it actually changes. This is what's so fascinating about the third-party reproduction. So a lot of the patient at certain age in their, you know, say late 30s, early 40s, have had different relationship when it didn't pan out, and they have a backup plan. And that backup plan may mean using a friend's sperm, either a gay friend or someone that they've dated in the past. So that's called a designated or directed sperm donation. And there's a lot of dynamics that goes into each one of those treatment plans because The question is whether or not that sperm donor is going to be acting as the father of the child, whether he's going to be responsible financially, emotionally towards this child, and so forth. So this is an option for patients who are not interested in using anonymous sperm donor and want to have a name or a face or even involvement of a sperm donor that is a directed sperm donor. It requires some extra testing. It requires some psychological assessment of both the recipient and the sperm donor based on the CDC and the FDA requirement. But it's a very doable process, and I would say that probably less than 10% of my single women use a directed sperm donation, but it's definitely become more popular in recent years.
So let's move on to egg donors. Can you explain the dynamics of egg donation?
So the dynamics of egg donation is something that we've been doing since the early 80s, and it evolved in the past decade because more and more patients are actually using a donor egg in a very similar fashion that using a sperm donor from an egg bank. So there's a lot of egg banks that have developed in the last 10 years since egg freezing has become so readily available. But let's say about 40% to 50% of patients are still using an anonymous egg donor who has to undergo an IVF cycle after she has been selected as the anonymous egg donor. When we sit with a couple or with a patient who are in need for a donor egg, it's usually because of failed prior IUIs or IVF or very low ovarian reserve or premature ovarian failure. Those patients will have three options. They will have the options of either using a fresh egg donor, using a frozen egg donor, or using, as we had mentioned before with the sperm aspect, a designated or directed egg donor, meaning a sister, a cousin, or a family member. In the first option, when we use anonymous egg donor, they can use either one of the Shady Grove Fertility Facilities that recruits and screen all the donors, and that would be probably the most popular way of doing egg donation, or using an agency. And we usually use agencies when it's a very unique ethnicity or background that is in need, a Jewish donor, an African-American donor, an Asian donor, and there are some agencies that specializes in recruiting those specific donors. In the second option, which is the egg bank, we will be guiding the patient as to what to look for, and the donor egg recipient will be selecting from an egg bank a lot of eggs, usually 6, 8, or 12 eggs. Those will be shipped to Shady Grove Fertility, New York, and we'll choose the sperm that the patient has selected, whether a partner or a donor sperm, create embryos and transfer those embryos back into the donor egg recipient. And in the third option, which is, I would say, less than 5% of the patient will be coming with a plan to use her sister or cousin. I've actually seen two patients like that this week who are going to be acting as their designated egg donor in a similar way that we've discussed this, the sperm donor that is a known sperm donor. It adds another layer of complexity. We do need to involve either a social worker or a psychologist for the screening process. There is a psychiatric test called MMPI or PAI that we have to complete, but the process is very doable, very successful, and at that point, it depends really on the donor egg's age rather than anything else. So the younger the donor is, the more likely the pregnancy will result from each retrieval.
Got it. And what about genetic complications that you have to factor in? You know, I imagine that with both egg donation and sperm donation, that's something that you have to take into consideration. Is that correct?
That is very much so the case. So every patient who is preparing for fertility treatment, we are doing a very extensive genetic testing and looking at over 280 genes. Those are autosomal recessive conditions, which means that in order to have an affected child, you will have to have both the sperm source and the egg source be carriers for the same condition, which is a very rare situation. It's actually less than 4% in the population in any couples that will be found to be positive for both the same gene. So the same thing happens when a patient is in need for a sperm donor. Every sperm donor in every sperm bank is being tested for the very least for the four common genetic conditions, cystic fibrosis, spinal muscular atrophy, and a fragile X in female cases, and hemoglobin electrophoresis. And those are the first four genetic conditions because those are the most common genetic condition that are found in newborn. When it comes to an egg donor, we usually do a full panel because in many cases, the egg donor have her egg split among one, two, or even three recipients, and they'll have to be matched with the three sperm sources, whether it's husband, a donor sperm, a boyfriend, or what have you. So you're touching upon a very important point, which is genetics, which is also a field that has evolved significantly in the last two decades. And we want to make sure that when we're helping couples have a child, that child will be free of any genetic complication, as you called it, or genetic condition.
Okay. And I want to move on to the third option, the gestational carrier. You know, for whatever reason, if someone is unable to get a donation of sperm or an egg, or they just choose not to, then I imagine that this gestational carrier is their only option. And I can also imagine that it adds yet another layer of complexity because it involves another human being. So could you walk through the process with us?
Sure. So gestational carrier is available in many states. And as of February 2021, it's actually approved also in New York State, and we've done several cases already just in the first few months of 2021 because it's so much in demand. It usually applies for women who have a uterine factor, either a fibroid, adenomyosis, or prior C-section that got complicated, or some women were born without a uterus in a condition called Meyer-Rukotansky syndrome. So those women will need a gestational carrier to carry their pregnancy, and other type of patients are patients that have had a very complicated delivery and the baby was born prematurely or they had preeclampsia or diabetes. In that situation, we will be screening a patient, which is additional complexity, as you mentioned, to be the carrier for the 9 months of the pregnancy. That patient will have to undergo certain tests. It's called a hysterosalpingogram, which is a fallopian tube test, but it also checks the cavity of the uterus, a saline sonogram, and we usually give that patient 2 weeks of estrogen to try and build up the endometrial lining to make sure they're going to be a good carriers for the embryo that will have to be transferred. In any case of a gestational carrier, IVF has to be involved, meaning we will have to create embryos, whether it's going to be the patient's own eggs, the partner's sperm, or a donor egg and a donor sperm, but IVF has to happen. We create embryos, and once we have embryos that are developed to day 5 or 6, those embryos will be transferred in a separate cycle to the gestational carrier. And sometimes we do a coordinated cycle, which, as you had mentioned, it makes things very complicated. We could have potentially 4 parents here, the intended parents, the female and the male. We can have a donor sperm and donor egg, and we can have a gestational carrier who's the patient who's actually carrying the baby and delivering the baby and giving it to the intended parents. So in some scenarios, you can have 3, 4, or even 5 parents that are involved. Intended parents, male and female, a donor sperm, donor egg, and a gestational carrier, which makes things very interesting but very complicated in times. And just add to that the financial burden and the emotional burden and the legal burden, and you can imagine how fascinating this field of reproductive medicine, and especially third-party reproduction, is really.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. So if someone is listening to this, and for whatever reason, they haven't been able to have a child, and now they're kind of being exposed to these different options, walk us through the first steps that they should take and who they should talk to first to evaluate what's best for them.
So I think that, first of all, I would like to start with telling those listeners that there is a very good chance that they'll have a good outcome and have a healthy baby at the industry's process. And there's different ways to have a family, whether you're single, whether your uterus is not functioning, or whether you're older and have waited a long time for this to happen. The process usually starts with a simple phone call to a reproductive endocrinologist. There are over 400 IVF centers and fertility centers throughout the U.S., more so in big cities, but also in some rural areas. So you make an appointment, and during that consultation, you spend about 45 minutes to 60 minutes to outline what are your goals, how many kids you would like, and what testing have you done in the past, and when do you want to get pregnant, and how quickly. Once you establish that goal, the testing will commence, and that testing will include the genetic testing, semen analysis if there is a partner involved, ovarian reserve testing, which will include an anti-Mullerian hormone, an AMH, and also day 3 bloods, which are blood tests that are done during day 2 or day 3 of your full flow of your period. And those are called estrogen, FSH, and LH. And lastly, you will do an uterine assessment test, which is called a hysterosalpingogram, or in short, HSG. Once you complete those 5 tests, the genetics, the uterine assessment, the fallopian tube, the ovaries, and the sperm, you get a good sense of where the issue lies. If there is a bad sperm, we may have to use a sperm donor. If there is low ovarian reserve, we may have to use an egg donor. If the uterus is non-functional, then we may have to use a gestational surrogate or a gestational carrier or have to do surgery in the uterus. And if the fallopian tubes are abnormal or blocked or dilated, then you do IVF and you bypass those fallopian tubes. So to whoever is listening, there's so much development that has happened in reproductive medicine in the past 40 years since the inception of IVF in 1978 and since the development of intracytoplasmic sperm injection, what's called ICSI, since 1992, that allows women with very low ovarian reserve, with very low sperm count on the partner's part, to achieve a healthy pregnancy. Lastly, I would tell couples or single women who are not ready for conception but would like to know what our options are in the future is to go and freeze eggs, because the younger you are, the better the eggs are that you're going to be ending up using well into your 40s. The younger you are, the less time you'll go to an egg retrieval or an egg freezing stimulation. So I can tell you, someone who has two daughters, they don't know that yet. They're still 10 and 11. They'll have to freeze their eggs, you know, if they plan to attend college. And I think that now most women freeze eggs in their 30s. But a decade from now, it will be pretty clear that it's better to freeze eggs in your 20s because the egg quality is much better.
You know, I think just one thing that I'm taking away from this conversation is that there is so much hope that technology and medicine has advanced so much, and it really makes it possible for people that want to have a family to do so now. So it's wonderful. One topic I wanted to just close with is that, obviously, as fascinating as third-party reproduction is, I imagine that it's also complex, right? There are social considerations, ethical, and even potentially legal considerations. So can you speak to some of the dynamics that you see patients go through as they're making the choice or trying to decide whether third-party conception is right for them?
Definitely. I think that one of the things is genetics. So when we talk about ethics, a lot of patients choose to do IVF and to screen their embryos for chromosomal abnormalities, and also by default they find out if it's a male or a female embryo. So that's one question that comes to mind. Should we allow a patient to choose to put a male or a female and not to transfer an embryo that has certain genetic condition? Things that were not even on the table just 30 or 40 years ago. The second question when it comes to genetics is patients who are carrier for certain condition. For instance, BRCA gene, which is a gene that causes breast cancer or ovarian cancer, I have a lot of patients who are female with BRCA positive genes who are coming to do fertility treatment, not because of lack of fertility, but because they would like to avoid or save their daughters from having to go through a breast mastectomy or oophorectomy, removing the ovaries, and doing IVF for that purpose alone. As I feel very comfortable doing that, some doctors don't. The third dilemma is that when a patient is using a sperm donor, she's essentially determining the child's father in many ways, and whether or not she should choose anonymous sperm donor or an open sperm donor, it raises a big question. And when a patient is single, I usually recommend considering using an open donor from the sperm bank to give the child, the son or their daughter in the future, the option of potentially contacting that donor. There are some countries in the world, like in Europe and in Sweden, that sperm donation has to be open and there is a registry, which brings us to the next dilemma, because when a patient chooses a donor sperm, by default, that donor sperm is used with other patients as well if it's taken from a sperm bank. So you're creating half-siblings, and there are registries out there. So your child, your son or your daughter, could potentially find out in 20 or 30 years from now that she has a half-brother or half-sister in different parts of the world or different parts of the country. So this is something that will be addressed with a social worker or a psychologist before we even embark on selecting the donor sperm. Same goes with the egg donation. At this point, all egg donations are anonymous, but 5 or 10 years from now, with face recognition platform and different genetic database that are available now with 23andMe and Ancestry and so forth, there's a good chance that there's going to be a way to identify who was the egg donor or who was the sperm donor. So I think that transparency, honesty, speaking to your child, speaking to your doctor about all your concerns, bringing it up to the table is key. With genetic screening now of embryos, I believe that in a decade or two, most pregnancies will be probably achieved using artificial reproductive technique. I think a lot of patients that have suffered recurrent pregnancy losses with chromosomally abnormal embryos are not know that this technology is fascinating. You take eggs, you take sperm, you create an embryo, you analyze it in the embryology lab, and you can screen for all the chromosomal abnormalities, avoiding the need to undergo termination of pregnancy if it's a very devastating chromosomal condition, which, as we know now, and by hearing, listening to the news, in some states is even illegal. So I think that more and more genetic development, technological development will help us, but also will open different ethical and legal aspects that we'll have to address. Lastly, I would say that if a patient is not sure about her partner, it's probably better to freeze eggs or use anonymous sperm donor rather than use a friend or someone that she feels comfortable to have a child with, because sperm donor, if it's a directed sperm donor, has the same, it has rights to decide not to allow that patient to use those embryos. And at times, it could be the only hope for that patient, because she had frozen embryos at a younger age, to have a genetic child. So you need to think long and hard of which egg you're using, which sperm you're using. And in the case of a gestational carrier, you have to feel comfortable with the gestational carrier carrying your pregnancy for 9 months, make sure that she's committed to the process, not using any drugs and alcohol, and making sure that she will be the one who's communicating every step of the way with the intended parents and how the pregnancy is going and involving the intended parents. A lot of emotion goes into that.
Yes, I can only imagine. You know, Dr. Singer, one thing I always like to close on is I imagine that you've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of people that are considering third-party reproduction. And in all of your experience, everything that you've learned, if there is one thing that you could share with our audience before we go today, what might that be?
It would be keeping an open mind and realizing that no matter how you're going to achieve that pregnancy, whether it's a donor sperm, donor egg, a gestational carrier, there's a lot of ways to have a family and have a child. And you won't be less connected or love the child less if it was after a very long journey using a donor egg and a donor sperm or gestational carrier at times. Patients who actually went through this, and I can tell you from my 15 years of experience, have never looked back and said, this was my journey, it got me to where I wanted to be, and I love this child more than life itself. So be open-minded, be optimistic that there's definitely a lot of options, and don't give up hope.
Well, Dr. Singer, I think that is the perfect place to end. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Tomer Singer, a board-certified specialist in reproductive endocrinology and infertility with Shady Grove Fertility. Thanks for checking out this episode of the Shady Grove Fertility Podcast. For more information, please visit shadygrovefertility.com or call 813-906-2285 to make an appointment. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels and be sure to check out the entire podcast library for topics of interest to you. My name is Prakash Chandran. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk next time.